listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So tonight we're going to hear sentences. We're going to think about sentences. And we're going to think about sentences that make stories and sentences that don't. We'll hear readings from Dinah Lenny, Matthias Wigner, and Anne Germanicus, and then a conversation among all three of them, moderated by Jim Crusoe. And we'll celebrate, as we all collectively decided to call this evening, the not exactly random, extraordinary, ordinary key of life. And I sense, I was thinking today, as I was so pleasurably reading all three of these authors' work, I was sensing that the spirit of Gertrude Stein might also be here in the taper with us tonight. A sentence is not emotional, a paragraph is, Gertrude Stein famously said. She also said, the great question is, can you think a sentence? Stein was interested in how we arrange our words, our thoughts, our sentences, and what happens if you don't know what sentence comes next. Then you'll be surprised, won't you? We'll hear sentences tonight that add up in Dinah Lenny's beautiful new book, a series of interlinked essays called Object Lessons, to stories of a dog's collar, an inherited piano, a tale about earrings that are, quote, a pale round star in the lobe of her ear, a circle of stone shot through with light, not emerald or chartreuse or aquamarine, a color like no other, faceted, rimmed in black enamel and gold, and studded with tiny diamonds. Dinah Lenny's book projects a mosaic of life and love, of coming to terms with place, of dealing with upended notions about home and family, career and aging. And how does a portrait of life emerge from random sentences? Matthias Wigner, in his powerful book, 25,000 Random Things About Me Too, asks, does randomness exist? In his sentences, his lists, you'll learn about the death of Kathy Acker in Tijuana, about why his father prefers the mute button on the remote control, about the Dutch artist Jan Baas Otter, who died in a sailboat at sea, and other strands that find their way to other strands of thought, resisting but seeking closure. He tells us that making lists, quote, at first feels enormous, like a new planet or a whole new wing on your house. Then it feels very small, like trying to squeeze a sofa through a cat door. He has a way with sentences. And Anne Germanicus's daring new book, Tribute, is a kaleidoscope, flashing insights followed by reposes, which, as one critic noted, you could read this book in an afternoon or over years, and either would be right. Mothers and Daughters, Freud, Sex and Desire and Politics, Greece and Palestine, the streets of San Francisco, are all here in the perambulating mind of a woman grieving in the wake of her mother's death. In order of appearance, we'll hear tonight Dinah Lenny, the author of Bigger Than Life, A Murder, A Memoir, and her new book, Object Parade, is out from Counterpoint. She serves as core faculty in the Master of Professional Writing program at USC, I wrote USA, that was good, and in the Bennington Writing Seminars. Matthias Wigner is an artist, author, and critic who teaches at CalArts. He's one of the founding members of the art collective Fallen Fruit. He writes regularly on art for many publications, and his book, 25,000, is that right, Random Things About Me Too, was published in 2012 by Les Figues Press. And Anne Germanicus is the author of the short story collection In the Time of the Girls. And together with her husband, Nick, she ran the Ithaca Cultural Studies Program on the islands of Kalymnos in Crete. And her new book, just out from Rescue Press, is called Tribute. And our moderator, Jim Crusoe, an accomplished author, has published 5 novels, 2 books of stories. His first novel, Iceland, was published by Dalkey Archive Press in 2002. And since then, Tin House Books has published Girl Factory, A Race Towards You, and Parsifal. He teaches writing at Santa Monica College as well as at Antioch's MFA program, and he's also published 5 books of poems. It should be a fun night. Please welcome our first reader, Dinah Lenny.
Thank you, Louise. Can you hear me? Yeah. So thank you all for coming. I'm so delighted to be here with Matthias and with and with Jim, who has been a profound influence on me. So I'm very delighted to have this chance to be here with him. And you're also nice to come. And I should tell you, the book is called The Object Parade. And each essay in the book starts with an object, with something that's familiar to me, or something that I made up, or something that I lost, something that I found. So I brought a prop. It's not that I don't have faith in my sentences, but just in case, I brought this spoon. Can you see it? It's flat, yes? I'm going to read to you about the spoon. This spoon flattened, not a spoon at all, couldn't spoon anything, no. It's a fossil, an effigy, a spoon for a paper doll, except too weighty. Well, a mirror then. A tiny glass with a too long handle, but a prop, a pretend thing. No reflection to be found in its face. It's made of stainless, not silver. This spoon came from the dining room at the Miramar, that old family resort just off the Pacific Coast Highway on a hill overlooking Santa Barbara and the sea. The Pacific, that is, that vast expanse of blue, that infinity pool of an ocean with none of the zigging and zagging of the Atlantic, none of its temper, not down as far as Santa Barbara anyway, all equanimity south of Cayucas, at least from afar, though quirky and angular, frigid and dangerous at its shoreline farther north. But the Miramar, faded, comfortable, worn at the edges, affordable. A few main buildings visible from the road, and then pulling into the lot, the landscape dotted with tiny white bungalows roofed in royal blue. Such an odd piece of property, a train running through it, hence the flat spoon, along with a couple of forks also filched from the dining room, plus quarters and pennies, nickels and dimes, nothing but discs now, wafer thin, their names, dates, values smoothed away. We'd leave them on the tracks summer after summer, wait for the trains to come, then pick them up afterward and stow them in our bags, entirely worthless, inestimably valuable, instant souvenirs, better, useless as they were, than regular spoons and forks, better than small change, though in fact those long weekends were all about the dole every time. Can I have a quarter? Can I have two? Can I have some money for the soda machine, for the candy machine, for the popsicle cart, for the ice cream shack, for the train? Will you take me to the snack bar, to the lemonade stand, to the restaurant, back to the train tracks, please? And we didn't worry about that train. A straight line had cut the property in two. We could see it coming from afar, left our loot on the rails, and when we heard the whistle, ran to watch, held hands from yards away. It blew back our hair and our summer dresses, then rushed in to collect and inspect the remains. An activity, an adventure that never lost its shine, not for the under 10 set. And all of them under 10 in those years, under 9, 7, 5, 3. The Miramar. We went in droves once a year, every year towards the end of summer. A whole neighborhood, a whole community of people, so many of us transplants on this coast from the East or the Midwest. We glommed onto each other and pretended for all we were worth until it was true. We were makeshift family. We who'd come to Los Angeles on a lark, on a bet, and stayed without ever deciding that's what we were doing, we who found ourselves suddenly ensconced, suddenly homeowners with two cars, two dogs, two children's, and no uncles, aunts, grandparents to pick up the slack. Blood relations in short supply, we stuck our necks out, cooked for each other, drove for each other, stood by each other, and all together planned our family vacations in the last weeks of August, found ourselves at the Miramar, where the children could wander, where we grown-ups could put our feet up, the ocean just outside our windows, fat novels in our laps, our televisions tuned to the U.S. Open. Year after year and day after day, we lay across our unmade beds, sand and crumbs in the rumpled sheets, watched the people in Queens fanning themselves while those Santa Barbara breezes turned the pages of our books and tickled our exposed upper thighs. Up to our ears, we were in crusts and dregs, our rooms littered with the remains of grilled cheese and macaroni and cheese sticks, abandoned root beer floats and floaties, half-eaten fruit and half-chewed fruit roll-ups, and our kids everywhere, all over the property, turning up now and then here and there on bikes, on skates, in helmets and goggles, smelling chlorinated, salty, just slightly mildewed in their soggy suits. And all this debris, only evidence of good health, prospects, if not prosperity, fertility, sexual viability. We were young then, too. And in that place, I let down my guard. It wasn't the beach that called me, or the pool, or the bar, or the sun, or the water. It was the way the hours stretched before me, unspoken for, uncluttered. Once there in those cool, sparsely decorated rooms, the walls bare but for the occasional unsigned seascape, no trace of former occupants, no evidence of life in midstream, I somehow achieved liftoff. I floated outside the whole business, everything muffled, muted, even my own responses, which seemed to come from somebody else, slightly delayed and out of sync, as if I were watching and listening, not watching, not listening, from far away or just swathed in bubble wrap, maybe. I didn't exactly look the other way, but neither did I react when one kid turned up mid-morning with chocolate ice cream all over her face, or the other put a straw in his second can of 7-Up well before lunch. I became speechless and slow-moving. It was all I could do to shake out the towels, to stand under the shower with my little girl at my knees, my hands in her scalp, absently rinsing the sand away. Cream rinse and cold cereal were my best defense, the most I could manage in my vacation stupor. Without asking permission, I turned inward, abdicated my responsibilities, a tacit agreement really under the pretense of family time, that I would disappear into myself. But for a morning search for sea glass, a twirl in the shallow end, a half-hearted round robin on the oceanside courts, I went missing, except for those trips to the tracks, where I could have stood forever waiting for the train, staring without blinking, willing it to come until I felt it first under my feet, then rushing me in the face, whipping me back, blurring my vision in the instant, causing the intake of breath and the folding of myself around the small person in front of me, or the gripping of that little hand in mind, until he squirmed or she squealed, until the train receded, not able to say what I'd seen or felt, but I'd been present at least, there when it happened, whatever it was. And then the tug on my fingers, the clamor, the race to retrieve the quarter, the fork, the penny, the nickel, the flatware, this spoon. Thank you.
Lovely. Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Louise. Where are you? It's a delight to read with Dinah, Anne, and with Jim, who I've known for many years. I won't preface this. I think it'll make sense as I read it, or maybe not, but it's okay. 2,500 random things about me. 70. It's in Roman numerals. I always have to translate them to myself. One, it's a good thing we do not judge the life, the public life of a nation through the quality of its public toilets. Two, when Camille was about 8, we had a game that began with her saying, "I would be a dog and you would be my master." After that, she would bark and jump, and my job was to placate or tame her. Three, today, I was walking in front of someone I knew. Someone I knew was watching me. I could feel him through the back of my head. I felt him looking at me. I saw my head from behind. Four, I would be a dog was mostly about Camille's rebelliousness and your resistance, or her subjugation and your mercy as her master. Five, on Sunday, I was on a panel with two people from the Echo Park Time Bank, where people bank time doing things for each other to set up a barter system that works without cash. They said that their big problem was hoarders. People who do things for others but never ask for help, so they're hoarding credits. Six, Peggy is barking in her sleep. She does this when she has dog dreams. Also, she runs, sort of. Her paws go back and forth, and she digs for things. Seven, Camille's favorite stuffed animal arrived via envy. One of our friend's kids had a plush black tiger, and she pined after it for weeks. But after she got her tiger, it was her favorite animal for the rest of her childhood. Eight, when I drive, I see a line 50 feet ahead, and sometimes I project myself into it like an arrow, and then behind me, two. This way, I become a line, just a mark on a plane. Nine, last week I took a walk around CalArts. around the building itself, I began to think about the difference between CalArts as an idea and CalArts as a place. 10. What's the difference between walking clockwise and counterclockwise? 11. Kathy Acker loved her stuffed animals. For a long time, animal number one was a rat, Ratty. Then there was a goat, a shark, and an octopus. I still have the goat. 12. The time bank only works if the barter system stays in motion. My hour helping you weed is worth your hour doing my taxes. But if everyone helps and never asks for help, then the system is half frozen. 13. When she was 10, Camille described her brain to me. It was like a house with a library, a cellar, and an attic. Some rooms were dark and some were bright. Some were too damp or cold, and no one ever went inside them. 14. My brother and I played with stuffed animals for years. We'd have tea parties for them, and for some reason our names at this point would be Lila and Maria. We fed them Hostess cupcakes, snowballs, and ho-hos. 15. There's a gesture of dropping things into the wind as you drive, leaving everything behind. I'm ready to leave things behind. 16. I remember seeing ads for Hostess Twinkies when I was a kid. They were cartoons, and Batman or Casper the Friendly Ghost would pacify his opponents with a Twinkie. 17. Pica is an eating disorder that involves habitually eating non-nutritive substances like peeling paint or rubber cement. 18. I remember my brother no longer wanted to be Lila. He said there was something wrong with it. 19. The German word for an injection is Impfung. The power of the Impf seems much better, much greater than that of Inj. 20. An exclamation my mother would often use is the word Pfui. It's kind of like Fui. Are they related? But it's more like Phi or Yuck. It's that same Pf pushing out. 21. A movie that made a big impression on me was Anastasia, the story of the woman who claimed to be the last surviving member of the Russian royal family. 22. I would play Anastasia with our cat, Blackie. She'd be the baby princess wrapped tightly in a blanket. I'd be the Grand Duchess, trying to smuggle her out of Russia, my room, so the Bolsheviks would not kill her. 23. It's always nice to come home to a bowl of cherries. 24. The only thing I remember about studying with Tsetvan Todorov in college is that he told us to beware of coherence. When you're reading something that is too coherent, watch out. It's dogmatic. Coherence signals a problem. 25. After the 94 earthquake, I remember thinking everyone I knew was dead and that my punishment had been to survive. I'll read a little bit of the next one because I want to keep it timely. 2500 random things about me, 71. 1. I'm celebrating the departure of one of my colleagues, the worst colleague and probably one of the most dangerous people I have ever known, a terrorist. 2. Peggy is so bony, I feel her at night, her skeletal self, soft hair, breathing, breaths like thoughts. 3. Nothing in the universe is like Peggy's ears. 4. The existential terrorist hides behind the law, for which he actually has contempt. 5. He uses rules against themselves, and he gets the enforcers of rules to either pity him or fear him. 6. I got a call from a friend of my cousin, Susanna. He told me she and her girlfriend were in a bad car accident, are in the hospital, and can't talk now, and don't remember how they got there. 7. I wish I could be like a dog, just drop down and have a nap any time. 8. Instead, my head is infested with words like fleas. 9. An existential terrorist plays the weakest person against the strongest. The weak one becomes a projectile aimed at the strongest. 10. He knows you have to get close to those you seek to destroy. 11. More than a few times, a publisher I once worked with canceled meetings because his cousin was in the hospital or one of his cousins had just been shot. 12. Peggy's natural impulse seems to be to get under the covers with me. The bed is like a womb, but also a veil between being asleep and being awake. 13. The existential terrorist compensates for lack of firepower by using either knives or poison. 14. He claims to be the victim rather than the aggressor, especially when he is being most aggressive. 15. Dogs love their sleep. 16. An existential terrorist always chooses the power of destruction over the power to create. 17. Peggy's so thin, she's more like a whippet than a Dalmatian. 18. He scorns anyone's claims of victimization and sees them as feeble ploys to gain power. 19. I stroke Peggy's hair like I'm playing an instrument. 20. I am little, and Peggy's giant body is curved around me like a movie theater. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you, Louise. It's wonderful to be here with Dinah, Matthias, and Jim. As Louise said, this book begins before a mother's death, goes through the mother's death, and then it's past the mother's death. That's all I think I need to tell you right now. I'm going to read from three different parts a little bit. Make of it what you will. Nothing wrote, nothing preconceived. Rejoicing in my own quiet but occasionally soul-slapping way. Maintaining tension, modulating it. Full moon, mooning around. Holding on to a secret has its price. You pay until you can't. Like a good analyst, like a good mother, a story holds. A sliver of perfection. Some organizing part of me goes dumb. No ledge, no circle of earth, no leg. Shaping, you kill. Some half-assed Michelangelo chipping away. Bliss? One line for me and another line for me. Within her sight. Suffer deprivation patiently? How about saying om and calling it a day? Reveal how revelation occurs? These spasms of sex a little like sobs. Just one long, familiar book with gods and goddesses. Fiction, right? Fragment by fragment, around and around and down various paths, having taken myself down to the nails. Either way, divided. Preparing to believe. A lifetime of no's. A second of immortality. I'm supposed to listen to my mother flail around in outer space, then put down the phone and eat my dinner? Feels like homicide, better than suicide. These words, a kiss you can't refuse. Need to put things in order, take a walk on a treadmill, translate something, be translated. What I would really like to do? Right between the lines. The sky is mute, nothing blue to it. The sea is immense and calm. We discovered that the peahen has been sitting on hollow eggs. This is my way of speaking to you, almost in the present tense. 30 seconds of rain, roses, dollops of frosting. 8 chocolate came back to life. Touching you from an uncanny distance. Walked to the beach at noon, swam, then back up the long hill. Lunch was grilled food, my husband, my chef. Then the food we make of each other. This lively animation. Cats prowl in the vines above the roses. Writing makes the present. What meditation does, stretches time, digs into it. A god procured in full knowledge. Just emptiness around surrounding the hemispheres. Always mosquitoes now, mid-May. But one need not be wedded to silence. You understand, an awareness of to escape awareness of time only to have it burst upon you at odd moments. An audible syllable, the only outcome of that journey. I'm breathing for you. There are levels and levels of intimacy. You never know. Look at, not back. His ego may squash mine. To bear sexual witness, is there such a thing? Figure out a way to shine at home. He's cooking for me. I'm exposing him in a piece I can't stop sacrificing on the altar of my body. But this gift is for him, simmering. Putting your money where your mouth is, always a gamble. Here now, tomato sauce that's been cooking for over an hour. It's the cinnamon that fills the house and makes you think you might be hungry even if you know you're not. This is my husband's doing, and then it begins again. Cut to politics. As a child, I loved these long, almost summer days. Now I'm more interested in the dark before dawn. Just lust. Fine now, we're fine, and I've resolved my... Begin with generosity as a value and see where you stumble. The birds go crazy when we fuck. In the stew, stirring things round, whisking things together, tasting. I can turn away from this concoction and you're still there looking at me. Huge gusts of wind between pauses. And your sexual greed, where do you place it on a continuum? I watch that line of ants arduously, marchingly carry a piece of something we neglected to put in our mouths. Pulled so taut by time, I'm almost always. Someone just arrived noisily with something. I can hear them stowing it. The life in the spaces between the sentences. Walked with him through the gorge to the beach, swam. Sometimes turn other and inside out, proofing my galleys. A gull flew over me so directly that I was able to understand just how narrow, like a blade, a bird makes its body in order to fly. Sucking and weeping at once. Just anything that occurs at any moment. But what I don't want to give up, the theory of your eyes. You ordain the fickleness of me, a couplet. Push toward a different hesitation, clad in syllables. It's about letting the mind spin. This may be where you come in. Good things come raining down, I open out an umbrella. The being of us opened, made rain. That's a god, isn't it? Sometimes he soaks me, sometimes the mist of you. Oh, making love to an audience, it comes naturally to you, he said. Fall is here, almost crisp. That dog's ears touched the leaves, swept them round. I can be solemn or less solemn. My mother is gone, her house has been sold. I put myself in the garment of her, weep into a pocket. Am now returned to you on this borrowed book of time. You, also a library? Thank you. Do we go over there?
Let's see if you sit down.
Okay. Mm.
Thanks again, all three of you. I must say that being a moderator is an interesting idea when I think of what I would be moderating between these people. But it's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to talk about fragments. I must say, about 3 months ago, a writer friend of mine came up to me out of the blue and gave me this quote. I think it was out of the blue, and I want to read it to you because I think it's wonderful. It's by the poet Anne Carson, and she said, "I like to deal with fragments because no matter what the thought would be if it were fully worked out, it wouldn't be as good as the suggestion of a thought that the space gives you. Nothing fully worked out could be so arrestingly spooky." And I like fragments a lot. It seems to me, when I think about them, that in real life, whatever that is, there's in a way two competing versions of our life. One of them is that everything makes sense if we can just get the right, stand in the right place. We will see that it all makes sense. And the other, obviously, is that nothing at all makes sense. The first one, I have to say, I think is the popular dream of most readers. We read to see sections of other people's lives that seem to make sense, and of course that's why it's called fiction. The part that's dear to my own heart is that it doesn't make sense. And honestly, my memories don't make sense. What I choose to remember, why one thing or over another, is not clear to me. How I wound up here, why I do what I do, it's all mysterious, okay? I like fragments personally because they give me a chance to see that the glass is both half full and half empty at the same time. They show me both parts of it. In a way, they're a little bit like poems. And the reason I like poems is because as you read the poem, you're also seeing the white space on the other side of it, this part that tells you, this is what I don't know. So it's a pleasure to be here and ask these questions. I want to point out a couple things and really explore them with our writers. One of them is that I don't know if you could hear it, sometimes I could, sometimes not, is the space in between those fragments, that those moments when the writer is stopping and trying to figure out what to say next. So what fascinates me is why one thing should follow another, how you choose what you're going to say, how you decide what you're not going to say, and in a funny way, where you begin. Those and other questions. So, okay, maybe I'll ask everybody. One more thing I'll mention. It's really fun to have these three particular people because I think that everyone here is using fragments in different ways. Dinah's piece seems to me almost like finding a container floating around in the ocean, opening it up and then unpacking it, seeing everything in that container. In your case, there's about 30 containers floating around.
Yeah.
Matthias is maybe the ship's gone down, and there's a and there's a lot of things, but taken together, they tell a story. And Anne's is interesting to me because honestly, it's the ocean itself. Mm-hmm. It's much of what you're doing is to me under the surface, and watching the currents and watching how things come together and come apart is fascinating. So that's interesting. So let me start with Dinah. Why fragments? I mean, why don't you tell coherent stories here?
So it's so funny. I thought I did. I love what you're saying, Jim, because I think, I did try when I put this book together to tell several coherent stories. I tried to make sense of what was incoherent for me. But the interesting thing is that we were talking about this earlier, that as a writer, as I was writing the pieces, they certainly didn't make any sense. I didn't know where I was going with each piece, and I didn't know how the pieces would fit together. So, and that, you know, that is much like life on a daily and an ongoing basis, that you don't know how it all fits together until you reach some artificial vantage point where you pretend that it made sense. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's this, that we're in, it's artifice, that we're imposing sense on our experience. But I don't write in any order. I don't know what I'm going to write about. I don't know when I pick something where it's going to take me. And so in that sense, I feel that the process itself is true to the real experience. Perhaps quilting the piece is something else for mm-hmm. me.
Mm-hmm. Matthias.
Wow. I guess I've mostly not written in fragments. I've mostly tried really hard to make very like coherent narratives and holds, and I love that. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but it's also very, I think artifice is the right word, right? It's just a very beautiful fabrication, and lots of my experiences and the experiences of the people I know are not coherent. They're not organized. They're in lots of parts. And, you know, there's always this kind of ongoing debate in anthropology and in the human sciences, right, that do we actually think narratively, right? Is narrative natural to us? And lots of people say, well, no, narrative is, you know, it comes later, right? We impose a story on a set of events after they're over, but we don't actually know we're in a narrative in life and while we're in the narrative. So it was very exciting to me to be able to write in a way where I could think very short term, right? Just let me get this part right, not have to sort of scheme about, did I set this up right, and am I going in the right direction, and did I make a wrong left turn here, and now I'm going to have to, like, you know, backpedal to get back to where I was going anyway. All that fell away, and that was very comforting. And I think similar to you, being in the nice thing as a writer to write in fragments is that you get to be in the moment. You get to be in the moment at every point, and that hardly happens enough in any part of anyone's life, as far as I can see.
Mm-hmm. Anne?
Yeah, just taking off from what you said, Matthias, absolutely, the joy and necessity of living in the moment and writing in and the moment, writing the moment, and is part of it. And of course, when the narrator's mother is dying, that's how one lives in the moment. There's no other way to live. It's a rawness that maybe requires fragments. At the same time, going back to artifice, I think that what I'm trying to do as a writer is to artificially impose an unimposing experience on the reader, if that makes sense. Of course, I am imposing something. I am the writer. It is artificial. It's edited. It's not stream of consciousness. But to give the reader the sense that the reader, too, has to impose something on it in reading.
Exactly. Being one of the things that I like so much about fragments is that the spaces between the fragments have a voice of their own. Mm. And we can just, sometimes it takes, I assume for you, maybe a day or two or longer to go from one fragment to another and to figure out the required logic that would take you there. Maybe not. Is that a yes and a no?
I could say that, yeah. When I was working, I you know, my goal, which I did most times, was to come up with 25 things every day, and then there was a lot of tinkering about the order. Like that was really important. And when I revised it into a book, there was also that same I realized that the power that I did have in was about the order and creating both surprise, continuity and surprise, right? And to me, it was a way to, similar to what you just said, it's letting the reader, it's giving you, the reader, more freedom, you know what I mean, to decide where to follow, how to follow, right? It's a little bit of release of control. I mean, I think it's not a total release. It's, you know, the writer is still writing, right? But there's something about that.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the fragmented books, the famous fragmented book that probably most people have read is As I Lay Dying, the Faulkner book. And when you start, I see that faith for both working two ways, both for the reader, that this is going to turn out to be, quote, valuable, whatever that is, but also for the writer, that if I keep going, I will land somewhere. And I'm wondering, were there in the process of your writing, this is a hard question to ask, but did you surprise yourself? What did you, at the end, what did you find out?
And I think I surprised myself every step of the way, right. And that's the point.
Mm-hmm. That was... Period. Yeah.
But that second part of your question, I'm so curious, Jim, to hear Anne say that the second part of the question was, did you discover something at the end that was, I mean, was there a particular thing or?
A particular thing? I didn't write it the way Matthias wrote his.
Uh-huh.
I wrote it across many months. And I didn't write it fragment by fragment. I didn't set out to write it fragment by fragment. I went back and created fragments.
Oh.
I saw fragments.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
so it was
very different. So the revision process was a completely different thing.
Yes. I mean, the originally what this would have been is like this high, you know, 20 books high.
Right.
So it came down to this. So it was very different process. And as far as the end goes, I had to create the end.
Uh-huh.
I had to create the whole, but the pleasure and pain of writing in fragments is that there is surprise, and it's all about surprise, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Keeping it open to surprise.
I mean, for me, I would say definitely I surprised myself, and if I didn't surprise myself, then it wasn't worth doing. You know, what the pieces that didn't work were the ones where I wasn't discovering anything. But, you know, it's funny, Jim, because I said earlier that you've been this wonderful influence in terms of my own trajectory. And I do remember, and this is a story that I tell, I remember being stuck in a writing project and running into you. We were at a gallery, actually, and we were standing in front of a painting. It's being in museums and driving, I think, are good ways to talk to people about things that are uncomfortable because you don't have to look at them. So Jim and I were looking at a painting, and he said, "How's the writing going?" And I said, "I'm not writing. I hate writing." And you said, "What question are you trying to answer?" And that changed everything. That opened up everything for me. I think, you know, I think this work, whether you're writing in recognizable fragments or not, this work is motivated by questions. And you better surprise yourself. I mean, I think.
Well, with Matthias's book, it was an interesting process for me as a reader because I picked it up kind of gingerly in a certain way. You know, I picked it up and I said, "What's this?" and started reading it. And one of the great pleasures was finding it sort of like watch the flesh come forward, watch the person come out of those fragments and to find the depth and to find the surprise and all that. What to say, how was the process of writing it for you? Was it similar or not? What were the hard parts?
Yeah, it didn't start as a book project. It started started on Facebook. It started posting these lists every day, which a lot of people were doing, and I didn't like it. I didn't, you know, many people sent me them, and I was like, I don't like this. I'm not gonna do it. And finally, like, you know, and so I thought, okay, I'll try one, and I was like, okay, It's not bad as I thought. and then I just decided to keep doing them. I don't know why. You know, there was something about the form. And then I really fell in. I just fell in, right? And it was wonderful for me because I was always kind of surprised by what I was doing. You should be, but you're not. Most writers I know, artists, period, you always reach a point where you just hate your project, you know, and you have to revise it again, and you want to, like, kill it. And that never happened here, right? I mean, I certainly had periods where I was more resistant and more kind of, like, engaged, but it I had, like a natural flow and a surprise. Yeah, I don't know if there's a better word than that, right? But it's that, like, laughing at myself, mm-hmm. which is a pleasure. You know, it's so nice when you can laugh at yourself. It lightens everything. And I think those are the moments that sustain me in the process.
What would bring you to one of your objects, Diana?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I really did wander. So sometimes it was a question of I was wandering around the house and picking things because I was trying to get myself writing. So it took a while before I realized that I was writing, that it was a larger project, that mm-hmm. I was pushing myself to write out of things. When I realized that I had a project, then I began to pick things in order to tell the stories that I thought were important to this project, so that I was prompting myself, but with a bit more guile. And in the final draft, it was filling in the gaps. You know, what objects are going to fill this story in to tell the whole thing in a way that's balanced as I want it to be.
Mm-hmm. And this may be an impossible question, but what's the difference between those sections you discard and those sections you keep? How would you characterize them?
Sound.
Oh, good. Explain.
Sound and meaning. You know, if I like good sentences, so or you know, something beautiful, and so it was. I mean, a lot of it is intuitive, you can say, which is not very helpful, of course, but.
But Anne, I was going to ask you if you had a musical background, because I, you know, I felt like when you were reading, it felt very musical to me.
I don't.
That's so interesting. Well, you're very musical.
I like singing and I like dancing, but I have no training in either.
But when you say sound, that
sound is what came to me in writing this book. I think the big difference between this and what I'd written before is that sound was a guide, really. Along with other things.
Well, I was hearing that too. In fact, I was reading it too beforehand, and I was wondering about that. I remember the first couple times I read Gatsby, honestly, I kind of shrugged. I wasn't so impressed by it. And then I heard it on tape, and I suddenly heard those vowels. And as a musical composition, I was completely knocked out. And that's what I'm hearing in your work too.
And your work seemed very poetic, very much like based on what I think it was poetic lines, right? And the freedom that poetry can give a writer. And Dinah, I actually thought of music for you much more and fugues, right? Mm-hmm. And there was a way in which you kept going between the spoon. You know, there was sort of fixed points. One was the spoon and one was the Miramar. Right, and there was just a beautiful rhythm that you had, and it was in the sentences. It was macro rhythms and micro. You know, there were all these structures, but fugue is actually what I thought of.
That's interesting. I I've had the pleasure of seeing this stuff on the page, and Jim, you've been talking about the space between the lines. I mean, it's, you know, so if you look at the essay about the spoon, there's no space. I mean, there's barely a paragraph break, but it is very much about sound for me. But it strikes me that I'm maybe filling spaces that somebody else would come and take out those, you know, I'm using multiple qualifiers and I'm, you know, and there are endless commas and many semicolons and many M dashes and I'm filling that white space with stuff. And I don't know what that means, but, you know, I will get counsel from someone.
And speaking of, what are you doing? What are you planning next, or what have you already begun at this point? I mean, where do you go from there? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I'm one of the things that I'm really there are certain things that I'm preoccupied with right now. One is the relationship between I'm very interested in the relationship between music and fine art and writing, and I'm eager to. And when you were saying that you wanted to write the white space or write the place, the space between the lines, and somehow, you know, I think with writing, it's always about longing to do something that you're not doing. And so I'm longing somehow to make music or to respond to art in some way, but not, I don't mean in an ekphrastic sense. It's something else that I'm after. So that's interesting to me. And the other thing that's preoccupying me a lot is this issue of genre lately. Mm. And the idea of why I'm so certain that what I write is nonfiction is very compelling to me. So I'm working a lot with tense and how do you write nonfiction about the future, for instance, is compelling to me. So
good one. Yeah.
Well, the future's not a fiction.
No. Yeah.
Oh. And what are you thinking about these days?
I've got a lot of stuff that I've got to go back and make something of.
So you have the sort of stacks there and mm-hmm. then go back. Mm-hmm.
And I'll go back and see what it is. I can't really even remember. I try not to remember. So that once again, that too is a surprise.
Yeah, you know, I think that's how Thoreau worked, of all people. He had just stacks and stacks of stuff in his books, and he kind of put them in these fabulous essays. Mm. Matthias?
I've started working on trying to do a new list project, which would be 25 random things about you. And when I was doing the first one, I'm not confessional. I didn't want to write a memoir, and I got very frustrated. So I lit upon the idea of like, I'll talk about my mother or my dog, you know. So it's like, you know.
Because that's not memoir.
Right, that's not memoir. But it's about, right? My dog is about me. My dog is here or there, right? It's the other way we use about me is, or, you know, four chairs, two tables. So this is different and it's harder in a way because I'm actually talking to different yous on the same page. I'm not naming names. I'm talking to some yous directly. Many of them are just, I'm talking to you, right?
Whoever you are.
Which, right, one of the yous. But I'm not naming the yous. So the yous start, you know, and it's interesting because it's about the role of other people in our lives, right? And how they're all different, but they're all not me.
So you think.
So you think. Exactly. So we're told.
Because I was writing about a spoon.
Well, yeah. Well, right. Spoons can't talk back. Yeah.
Does anyone have questions that you would like to ask? Because it seems to me there's lots. Yes. Microphone.
Do any of you choose a particular kind of music to play while you're in the creative, the writing, the redoing, or the editing process?
I need silence.
Yeah.
Yeah, the
absolutely
sounds of silence.
Nothing.
I mean, ambient, you know, noise, but I can't, because I love music so much, I would never get anything written if I were listening to music.
Well, and it would infiltrate, wouldn't it? The rhythms would infiltrate the writing.
So I can't, but I know that lots of writers do, you know, if somebody's writing a story, you know, I mean, I know writers that listen to music according to the region that they're writing about. I just can't.
Likewise.
Okay.
I don't know if this is relevant, Anne, but when Dinah was asking you about, you know, being or noticing that the musicality, and you said you didn't have a background in music, but do you think that the fact that you speak several languages, I mean, the fact that you kind of hear other languages in your head, how does that play into your right ear?
Yeah, I think you're right. Just for those of you who obviously don't know, I have lived in two languages, Greek and English, for most of my life, and I've been studying several others for the past, I don't know, decade, let's say. And so, yeah, who knows? Clearly, there are sounds that play in my mind, which I can't get onto the page because they're sounds from other languages. Mm-hmm.
Do you ever want to write in the other languages or to use the languages in the text?
I'm going to fiddle around with some translation at some point, but I think more than getting the actual words translated, it's those sounds that are and rhythms of the other languages, which I don't think they come out in my prose, but it's a larger... what would we call it? Sonic world, mm-hmm. than maybe one has with only one language moving around in one's head. I don't know. It's like music, maybe.
I always really envy writers who write who have more than one language, and particularly I envy the writers who choose to write in English, even if it's a second language, because I think they pay attention in a way that I don't. That if I were to, you know, there are things I take for granted and I can be glib. And I think if I had other languages, I wouldn't be so quick on the draw, perhaps.
English is technically my second language. I learned when I was 5. And I'm obviously fluent. But but I, unlike my brother who was much younger, I can remember being corrected, making mistakes in English. Mm. So I'm very English was always my best class because it was like, you know, immigrant kid, get it right. Very much. And for me, it's actually, as I get older, it's harder to separate the languages. And I get, like, I play a little Scrabble game on my iPhone, and sometimes I'll just come up with a word in German. And I was like, no, I can't use that. And it just keeps sticking, right? Yeah. Or French. Those are my two languages. I was like, wow, how does that happen?
Yeah, I sometimes think, and I only speak one language, but I think that sometimes having another language is like having a secret language or a private language. I mean, I have another, the only other language I speak is to my dog, and it's in his language, and we are the only two speakers of that. But it's important to have that mm-hmm. privacy. Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Take one right here. I'm curious if you consider that your books have a beginning, middle, and end in that order. And as I was listening to each of you, I felt like I could pick up the book and jump around and hop around. And would that upset you if your reader did that?
No, I my brother told me once, he said, it's great because I can put it down any point and pick it up and I don't feel like I've missed anything. I very deliberately didn't have beginnings, middles, and ends. I mean, I did sort of, which I teach in a writing program, and sometimes when people, writers, are struggling with a beginning or an ending, I say, you know what? Don't begin, just start, right? Don't end, just stop. Find a good place to stop. So I do think about starting and stopping. I don't really think about middles. But you know what I mean by the difference between beginning and...
Well, it sounds like you're always in the middle, which is true to life, you know?
Kind of, you're always there, yeah.
I don't care if you read my book out of order. I mean, you certainly, it's a collection of essays, and you, theoretically, you can absolutely pick it up anywhere. I do introduce a cast of characters, and I am following them. There's a chronology to the book. So it would be a different experience if you read it from beginning to end than it would be if you picked it up out of order. And also, it has a very deliberate prologue and epilogue. But I once asked a wonderful poet, Amy Gersler, how she feels about people when she puts a poem out in the world. How does she feel if they they interpret it in a way that she didn't intend? And she says, she said, you know, once I've put it in the world, it's not mine anymore. And I'm trying to learn that kind of humility.
I think that there are a couple of different ways of reading this book. You can dip into it, you can move around, and that would be one experience. But there is a forward narrative thrust, and people have told me that they get going and they just keep going. So I think that speaks of something having to do with a beginning and a middle and an end, maybe.
Do you feel any compunction, to write to specific themes, whether you start with a theme or whether you find one on the way? Do you feel at the end that you have addressed something very specific that you're trying to talk to the reader about?
No. Are you addressing anybody?
You.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll go first. The themes keep coming around again, and that's part of the trust, I think, on the one hand, and it's the editing on the other. So yes, there are themes, and yes, I attempt to fulfill my duty toward them, let's say. I hope they come around full circle in some way, not in the usual mode.
I'm not interested in themes as much as I'm interested in ideas or concepts, but it's really ideas. And I think what was hard for me when I was trying to write fiction was, what's the story? Where are we? What is it? Morning? How did they get here? Are they in the car? Or are they out of the car? In a way, like I want to talk about love, right? I want to talk about what love is, how does it work? I know that I don't want to do it in a straight kind of essay, what is love, right? I don't want to do it that way, but I think what I've always wanted to do, and I think I got a good ways in this book, was to sort of find ways of talking about concepts or ideas that are so important to me, right? Being foreign, right? Or being American, major theme for me, right? Without giving you an essay, right? But just like through an arrangement of parts, right? To sort of unpack these things that are so beautiful and complicated and knotty. Knotty.
If I write to an idea or a theme, I'm going to get in really big trouble. So I try not to think about those things at all. And then, afterwards, sort of in the editing, revising, certainly I have ideas about what I'm, I'd be lying if I said that I didn't have as soon as you start writing about your family, you have ideas. But when I decide that I want to write about an idea, I get in trouble. The writing is general or obvious, or I'm hitting the reader over the head and with my point of view, and now here's a theme, and that's so I really have to find that stuff afterwards in revision. Mm-hmm. So then when I go back and revise, sometimes I'm revising to get rid of the theme. It's like, oh God, I'm hammering at my reader about this theme. So sometimes what I'm trying to do is get that out of there. So to get, because I don't deal with a lot of white space the way these writers do. In these two projects, they've given the reader all kinds of room to imagine themselves into these projects, and I'm not giving the reader that kind of room. Therefore, I have to be careful that I don't, knock my reader over the head with my ideas and my themes.
An example, not to change the subject, but an example to that actually occurs to me is with the existential terrorist that was in the toward the end of my reading, who's a real person, right? And like a monstrous person. And I didn't really want to tell you the story of all the awful things he did, right? But I did want to look at, like, why are monsters monsters? Right, and how do they do what they do? Right, what's the process of their monstrosity? Right, that's I really wanted that, you know, and I love, that's one of my favorite parts, is to just get to really, you know, and I don't even know if he'd recognize himself.
They usually don't.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Dinah, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Are you tempted at all after reading with us and talking about these things tonight to fool around more with white space, or is that something you'd never want to do?
Have we seduced you?
Yeah.
So I use white space, and I jump around. I certainly make leaps.
Right.
And I'm a big fan of the braided essay. I'm hugely interested in connecting things that are not connected. Mm-hmm. So I'm already using white space. I'm not at this point. I'm not at this point tempted to go. I'm so interested in paragraphs. I love paragraphs. So, and I love building a paragraph, and that's very exciting to me, to see how sentences accumulate. So I'm not yet prepared to do what you guys are doing, but I'm full of huge. It gives me great pleasure and I admire you. I'm just busy with my paragraph.
Well, we write single sentence paragraphs.
Right, and I do too. Look at that spoon. I mean, really, you know, you cannot believe how long those sentences are. There's one up there, and one down here.
Hi. I was wondering, one more that comes up in our conversation is fragment, but I was also wondering about fractal and fractal patterns and the connection between the disconnection, and particularly thinking about the idea of fragmented bodies and the work that our bodies do across time and space. And whether in writing the fragments you've learned something about how bodies are influenced by the spaces around them and how they come out in language. Mm. Does that make sense?
I think I would turn that around and say that the body teaches the body in space and time allows the trust in the fragments, in the eventual wholeness of fragments. Does that make sense? Okay.
I feel like I'm going to give a kind of a teacherly answer. So the Western tradition is mind-body dualism, right? Which is, there's this body here, and then there's this high good part of me, right? And they're connected, but they're separate, right? And a lot of my work has been sort of thinking through that and away from it, and it's like, you know, my foot's doing something down here and I'm thinking something up here, and then what's this palpitation? Do you know what I mean? To let everything happen simultaneously and not try to organize it into a master system that's about control.
I think they've answered you beautifully. I'll stay out of that one.
Hi. Thank you all. I have like a whole lot of writing here of just everything that you all have said. So what comes up for me as I'm listening to just all of the readings and all of the conversation is Eckhart Tolle's The Power of Now, and the important work that it seems that Fragments are doing to bring people or bring readers into the now and be maybe interactive, to create space in the work in the space between sentences. And so I'd wonder if you all could maybe speak a little bit about time in relation to Fragments, a little more about that, but also how Fragments can reflect life in a now space, in a very like fast-paced time when everything is sort of like maybe instant gratification or about thinking about the future. It's really, that work is really interesting to me, and it seems like you all are saying that Fragments can do that work when talking about life transitions or trauma or just daily reflecting daily living.
Whoa. That's Ebony Williams, one of our grads at CalArts grads. Taught you well. You came with a lot. We didn't teach you everything. That book, The Power of Now, is my favorite self-help book, and you know, and I'm embarrassed about it because you know I'm supposed to be an educated person, don't believe in self-help books, but I do love that book. I wasn't thinking about that book at all, but one of the things that I decided when I was working was that I was not going to think ahead, right? What was going to happen tomorrow or toward the end? And I was not going to go back. Like, every day I would write 25 things, I would organize them, and that would be it, right? And I knew that I would try not to repeat myself, right? I would try, but I wouldn't go so far as to reread so that I was sure I wasn't repeating myself. And of course, you repeat yourself because everybody has a certain like fixations that they come back to again and again. So it was nice for me to sort of always, you know, just every moment of that book, I'm just there in that one, you know, in that page, in that sentence. And that hasn't happened to me a lot in working.
So I can't really speak to the power of now, but I will say that I think generally, we're poised, even now, even in this age of instant gratification, it seems to me that we are poised between always. Human beings are just poised between, you know, it's the past and the future. You know, I mean, it's very, very hard to be present. At least I think it is. And I sometimes feel that I'm most present in the writing when I'm remembering. You know, I'm very interested in memoir, unashamedly interested in memoir and the way memory works and the way we're what I'm thinking of right now, and I don't know if this really, it doesn't answer your question, it's just sort of it's part of the conversation. I'm thinking of Thornton Wilder and Our Town, and how many of you have recently seen or read Our Town? And I mean, it's an astonishing play. It really is. And there's that incredible moment in the third act where Emily's dead, and she goes. She's not ready to be dead, so she wants to go back. And so she tries to go back into the past, and the dead warner, you don't want to do this, you're not going to enjoy this, but she does. She goes back, and what she discovers is that the past is much, much more vivid for her than now, and she tries to convince the people in the scene around her, pay attention to what's happening here, and they can't because they're in the present, and we don't do that in the present. So, but writing is a way to do that. And even when you're not writing about exactly what's happening. Do you know what I mean? It's a way to be very present. And I don't know if that answers.
Let's see. I'm at present not interested in memory. And this is a book which is called Tribute. It's the dedication is for my mother. But there's very little memory in it. It's all about, it's an attempt to capture time as it's passing. And that was, for me, as the writer, but it was also very much for you, the reader, and an attempt for me to give you a different experience of time from the one that we generally have in this day and age. So, it's up to each of you, I suppose, to find your way into it in whatever way you can. But that is what I would hope to offer more than anything else, really, a sense of just being in the moment. I haven't read the book, but of being in the moment and a sense of consciousness of time as it's passing, embodied in you.
That's a great closing statement, actually. The thing about Fragments that is, again, about being in the now is I don't think as a literary form there's another one that invites the participation of the reader as they're reading. As you get to put the book down, like Matthias's brother, you get to pick it up. You read the book at your own pace rather than the writer's pace, because there is no pace. So I think that's an amazing act of generosity and trust. I thank these three writers for being so generous as to be here, and to thank you for participating in this conversation. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.